do Ephesians next.
Oh.
That's what the decision was.
Yes. Like in 6 months or so?
No.
Like finish this
probably
one.
Maybe we'll finish today.
We'll,
I'm hoping.
Seriously?
We might.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right. I am way behind. Okay.
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm hoping. So I did want to share this one quote I ran into, which I thought was interesting. Remember, I've talked about several times when we've talked about the times of the Gentiles.
Yeah.
That it began with the Babylonian captivity of the northern kingdom, and then, or the southern kingdom, I mean, and then after the southern kingdom, which has the king in the line of Judah, after they came back, there's this intertestamental period, which is roughly 400 years after Malachi, before we start seeing the events of the New Testament occur in us. And so what's interesting, though, during that 400-year period is that there is no king in Israel, right? And so I pointed out that in Matthew's genealogy, all the names up to the Babylonian captivity, they're all kings. And then after they come back from the Babylonian captivity, these people are all still in the line of David that lead to Joseph. But none of them are ever a king. So it's kind of weird. There's all these guys and none of them are ever a king. And why not? If they're back from Babylon. And so as you read more about this period, intertestamental period, which generally is, you don't hear a lot about as a Christian, you have to kind of go and find material on it. But during that period, it's called the Hasmonean period, because there were different families that rose up in Israel to fight against some of the people that were oppressing Israel. So you have Babylon, Medo-Persia, and then you have Greece, Alexander the Great, and then he dies, and then from pneumonia, I think it was, and then basically his government gets split up among various generals, and then they start fighting, and then there's the Seleucids, a bunch of people that are in the Seleucids in the north, and in the south are the Ptolemies. Anyway, during this time there's all this infighting, and as it goes along you get to the one guy that we talk about here and there, which is Antiochus Epiphanes the IV, who is considered a precursor or a type for the Antichrist of the end, because he does things like he forces them to slaughter a pig on the altar, and he makes it illegal to have the Torah or to be circumcised or to practice the Sabbath. So he persecutes the Jews real heavily. Well, during that period of time, that triggers then a revolt from this Antiochus guy. And so that's where you would think. So Israel asserts its own independence and starts fighting against the Seleucids. And you would think that in that whole process they would have a king. Because now they're not even pretending to be under Persia or pretending to be under Alexander the Great. And so, but they still don't have a king. And so I was reading in an atlas, a Bible atlas, that was talking about that period. And here's what the guy said. And he wasn't even talking about the times of the Gentiles, and I don't think he's even thinking about it. But he says, during the Hasmonean period, the Davidic descendants did not distinguish themselves and even mysteriously disappeared from the scene. Mm. Leadership in the Second Temple period shifted to scribes and especially priests, probably because the successive foreign governments viewed priests as less likely to instigate political revolt. So you can see there the fact that there were quite a few times where they were under the influence of these external governments meant it was less likely for them to actually crown a king, because that would potentially be seen as seditious, right? But what's interesting here is he says that, you know, the Davidic leadership in the line of David kind of mysteriously disappeared from the scene.
Yeah.
Right? And we know why that is.
Yeah.
It's because God was continuing the times of the Gentiles. And so even though there were eligible Davidic guys, they never ended up rising up in the position of king. And it also helps you understand, too, that when Jesus shows up on the scene, remember there's that passage in after he's feeding the 5,000, I think it's right about then, where they want to seize him and make him king. There's and he
yeah.
and he avoids that. And part of that is this whole issue that the people were well aware too, that they did not, they have not had a king, a real king. They've had these people that bought the position of high priest. Like if you look at the Maccabeans and stuff, a lot of their influence and stuff, they were instilled as high priests. So the high priest position became kind of a political deal, and there was no king. And so when Jesus comes along, they're looking now for a king to overthrow Rome. And so their idea is that now is the time where this guy's going to be this political king. Anyway, it's interesting to read this quote because it's like they mysteriously disappear from the scene. I'm going, yeah, that's what I've kind of been saying too, without actually having read as much about it. So, yeah. So we're Ezekiel 47, and we're looking at the land allotment. So I'm wondering if someone can read verses 13 through 23 for us.
I'll give it a go. Man, I don't know. I don't.
What's all?
I don't sound things out very well. I'm not gifted in that area. David is very good in that. You're good in that, Mary. You give it a shot. That was pretty smooth, wasn't it?
I guess, kind of.
Ezekiel 47, 13 through 23?
Yeah.
Okay. Thus says the Lord God, this shall be the boundary by which you shall divide the land for an inheritance among the 12 tribes of Israel. Joseph shall have two portions. You shall divide it for an inheritance, each one equally with the other, for I swore to give it to your forefathers, and this land shall fall to you as an inheritance. This shall be the boundary of the land, on the north side from the great sea by the way of Hethlon to the entrance of Zedad. Hamath, Berathah, Zibraim, which is between the border of Damascus and the border of Hamath, Hazer Hadakon, which is by the border of Haran. The boundary shall extend from the sea to Hazar Enon at the border of Damascus and on the north toward the north. And on the north, toward the north, is the border of Hamath. This is the north side. The east side, from between Haran, Damascus, Gilead, and the land of Israel, shall be the Jordan. From the north border to the eastern sea you shall measure. This is the east side. The south side, toward the south, shall extend from Tamar as far as the waters of Meribeth Kadesh to the brook of Egypt, and to the great sea. This is the south side toward the south. The west side shall be the great sea from the south border to the point opposite Lebohamath. This is the west side. So you shall divide this land among yourselves according to the tribes of Israel. It will come about that you shall divide it by lot for an inheritance among yourselves and among the aliens who stay in your midst, who bring forth sons in your midst. And they shall be to you as the native born among the sons of Israel. They shall be allotted an inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel. And it will come about that in the tribe with which the alien stays, there you shall give him his inheritance, declares the Lord God.
Well done.
Nice. Yeah, nice.
I just made all that up. I don't know how you say any of it.
That's happened. Like I've said this numerous times, that there's hardly anyone alive that can actually pronounce those correctly, except maybe a few Jews in Israel, right, that are reading directly from the Hebrew, because the English translation is a real approximation to start with. And then there's disagreements, even like if you get audio pronouncements of Greek and Hebrew words, which I have from various, you know, seminaries and stuff. They disagree too about how to actually pronounce some things. I mean, they would sound similar but slightly different. Yeah. So it's like no big deal to get all caught up about it. Just go boldly, and if you're bold enough, it sounds good.
Right. Right.
However, you
sounds like I know what I'm doing.
You know, and there's all this issue too of which syllable to emphasize,
Did you get that?
I did. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So it's like a lot of like the Greek word, a lot of people say ecclesia. Okay. It's actually ecclesia. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's all these little subtleties, and we don't get them, half of them right anyway. So it's no big deal. So just be bold and go.
That's
all right.
Why I do, because yeah. You told me that before.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I can say it however I want.
Okay, so one of the things we see in this boundary, the division here, is that God kind of plays, for lack of a better way of putting it, he kind of plays a shell game with the 12 tribes, because Joseph has two sons in Egypt, right? Ephraim and Manasseh.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out that Jacob adopts Joseph's two brothers, or sons, excuse me. And so they're considered among the 12.
Mm-hmm.
When he wants to talk about Joseph, and he also wants to talk about Levi or not talk about Levi. So if you think of the 12 tribes with Joseph and Levi, there's times where he's going to do things where Levi's dropped out. And so then he splits Joseph into the two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and he still has 12. You see what I'm getting at there?
Sure.
So there's 12 guys, one of which has the two sons that are adopted. And so sometimes he'll talk about Joseph and Levi among the list of 12, and you won't hear Ephraim and Manasseh. And other times he'll, like in this list here, Levi doesn't have a land portion in the 12 that are listed. So Levi's dropped out of the list, but to make 12, then there's this idea of Ephraim and Manasseh, which are both Joseph essentially. So this double portion that goes to Joseph ends up being reflected in the two tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim. And so you see that in verse 13 where it talks about Joseph shall have two portions.
Okay.
What he's essentially saying there is instead of Joseph and Levi being among the 12, I'm not listing Levi, and I'm splitting Joseph and giving two portions to Joseph to cause it to be 12 pieces. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So each time you look at the list of the 12 tribes, sometimes you'll see Ephraim and Manasseh listed explicitly, and other times you'll just see Joseph, which infers those two as well, and in which case usually there's also a Levi. So, and this has to do with the whole business in where some of Joseph's sons, like Reuben, slept with his father's concubine, and then Simeon and Levi were the two that were real vengeful. Remember when Dinah was raped
and then went out
and so
had them all.
The first side. Yeah. So the firstborn blessing, which was supposed to go to Reuben, didn't. And it ended up going to Joseph, essentially. And the firstborn would get a double portion normally. And so it went, he skipped over Reuben, Simeon, and Levi and ended up giving this double portion, which is what the firstborn is supposed to get. So when it says Joseph shall have two portions, that was normally the case. So if you had like two sons, your inheritance would be divided in three, and two-thirds would go to the first son. And you know, so if you had four sons, you'd divide it in five, essentially, and two-fifths would go to the first son, and the other three would get the remaining fifths, right? So anyway, that's just one of the things that you see in here. And so then when you look at the land divisions, like we've looked at this before, this map of the land divisions in the Millennial Kingdom, you'll see you got Ephraim and Manasseh here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which would normally, if he'd have done it otherwise, you know, there's no Levi in here, right?
Right.
Right. So in a sense, when he splits Ephraim and Manasseh, he's really given Joseph twice the amount of land as the rest of the brothers. So Joseph is getting the double portion still. But Levi is then ends up down in this part, right? The priests. So that's just one of the ways that you see this split occur sometimes. Whatever. It's just something to be aware of. And then another thing that's different in this situation is, which I guess I should state on the map, is, so there's the Sea of Galilee and there's the Dead Sea, and that's the Jordan going down there. And so when Israel is about to go into the Promised Land, do you remember there's some of the tribes? So Moses gets to look over to the Promised Land from Mount Nebo, which is kind of opposite Jericho, which is up in this northern portion. And when he's dividing up the land according to what God said, there's some of the tribes want their land on the east side of the Jordan. They go, well, we really like what's over here on the east side.
But they still had to fight first.
Yeah. So God said, through Moses essentially, yeah, go ahead and let them have land on the east side, but they have to still come across into the Promised Land and fight for the rest of the tribes until Israel establishes the tribal allotments on the west side, then they can go back. So they leave their women and children, and I'm thinking some number of men, either under the age or over the age of war, there. And the rest of them all go over to the east side. So, but what we see now in this Promised Land situation is there's nobody on the west, on the east side of the Jordan anymore. They're all going to be on the west side. And then there's disagreement between different scholars about some of the lines that are drawn here, how far east they're supposed to be, and whether it's Jordan or whether it's supposed to go over to the Euphrates. And there's all different ideas people have about this, but this is the basic idea that you've got the tribes in horizontal stripes across the land, and then when you get to the Jerusalem portion, that's where you have that land for the Zadok priests, the Levites, and the prince that it talks about, and the city are all in that little section there. So, any comments or thoughts about that? So, one of the things you'll run into so there's various claims people make. Like, you'll hear people talk about the 10 tribes are lost. And obviously, this is yet future. The 10 tribes aren't lost, right? And you'll also hear people talk about, they'll make the claim, which is somewhat true depending on how you think about it, well, that the Promised Land isn't really mentioned much in the New Testament, right? But that's a little bit of a red herring, because everything about the future isn't in the New Testament, because this section of Scripture is about the future, right? So people will make the argument, well, because nothing's said about the land boundaries in the New Testament, that the Promised Land doesn't apply anymore in a geopolitical sense. But that's all, when you say that, you're also saying that the end of Ezekiel has no future fulfillment, because the end of Ezekiel... So what it comes down to is it doesn't really matter whether something's in the Old Testament or the New Testament. You have to look at the whole Bible and say, what does the whole Bible say is going to happen? You know, for example, I could go back to Genesis 3:15, where it says that the seed of the woman will have his heel crushed or bruised, and he'll crush the head of the serpent. And I could claim that, well, the serpent is still running around today. So there's a sense in which his head hasn't been completely crushed. Mm-hmm. It might have worked out judicially, but it hasn't worked out actually in fact yet. And so I can say, well, there's part of Genesis 3:15 that's unfulfilled. Right? Well, sorry, Tony, that's in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Right? But that's kind of the argument sometimes people make about these issues like the Promised Land.
Well, in all of, like, Isaiah, all the, in the 60s, that's all about the people coming back into the land, and that's not fulfilled.
So Mary's pointing out, too, that there's passages of Scripture that are after the periods in time when Israel, when people claimed Israel had all the land and fulfilled the promise of the land, and yet there's still prophets promising the land, right? So why are they promising the land, right? And part of that comes down to when you actually look at the promises related to the land, like at the end of the book of Amos especially, it doesn't just say they'll get the land, it says they will dwell in it forever. No more shall they be out of the land, right? So it's not just a matter that they're actually going to get this land, but also there's a permanence aspect to it, which of course has not been fulfilled. So there's a neat part in here too where it talks about the strangers or aliens who dwell among you, right? Verse 22. It shall be that you will divide it by lot as inheritance for yourselves and for the strangers who dwell among you and who shall bear children. Notice there's children being born.
Yeah.
And it says they shall be to you as native born among the children of Israel. They shall have an inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel.
Hmm.
Okay, that's very different.
Mm-hmm.
Than the rest of the Old Testament. Because in the Old Testament, strangers were still strangers. They didn't inherit land. You know, the Gentiles who were God-fearers or proselytes or whatever their various terms they were, they didn't actually inherit any of the tribal land. And they could, you know, they could live among Israel and follow Israel's God, but they never got land. So here again in Ezekiel we're seeing a different set of rules, and that's a clue that we're in a different section of time. Either that or it's a different God. You know, it's not the different God. So it's like the house rules are a little different. And so like we've seen, not only are the land allotments different, but even allowing strangers, sojourners, to have a place, a possession. A possession in a name kind of idea. So it's similar to what's said in Isaiah 56. Have you ever heard of a museum called Yad Vashem? Yeah, so it's a memorial from the Holocaust. About the Holocaust. And Yad Vashem means a place and a name. And it comes from Isaiah 56:5, where there's a verse there that says, it's basically saying, do not let the son of the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord say, the Lord has utterly separated me from his people. Nor let the eunuch say, here I am a dry tree, for thus says the Lord to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths and choose what pleases me and hold fast my covenant. Even to them I will give my house and within my walls Yad Vashem, a place and a name. So Yad is a place or possession, Va is and Shem is, Shem is name. So he said, I will give them a place and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name. Also the sons of foreigners who join themselves to the Lord to serve him, right? Even them I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. For my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. So notice he's saying there that people who were second-class citizens, if you want to look at it that way, in the Old Testament economy. Like eunuchs, for example. The eunuch type of eunuch he's talking about there is someone with a birth defect or was damaged, you know, through a fight or war or whatever, where they had physical damage, they weren't allowed to go into the temple. They were imperfect, right? And they couldn't come into the temple. And so there's this idea here in Isaiah 56 where it's talking about a time which I'm suggesting is connected to this same passage here, where the Gentiles, or people who are sojourning themselves among Israel that are not Jews, will no longer have this second class status, if you will. So again, we're in an age that's kind of in between these two situations. But again, you can see how different that is from other things the Old Testament talks about. And so the Holocaust Museum, that's called Yad Vashem, one of the aspects of one of its what do you call it, displays, is about righteous Gentiles, basically honoring Gentiles who, like Schindler and, you know, other people during the Holocaust who saved lots of Jews at considerable risk to themselves, you know, Corrie Ten Boom, people like that, who even the Jews in this Holocaust Museum recognize them as being key to the survival of the Jews, even though they weren't Jews, right? So there's the reason that Yad Vashem is named the way it is from this verse in Isaiah 56, but it includes this idea that not just memorial, but this idea of people who were not the chosen nation having full benefits because they want to follow God, right? And you see little echoes of that all through Scripture at different times, like when Jeremiah is down the well and about to die, there's I can't remember where he's from, but it's a eunuch that God uses to lower down some rags and haul him out, and then God makes a promise to that eunuch. But as a eunuch, he's considered physically mutilated and not on the same par of access as someone who's not. Anyway, interesting idea. So any thoughts about chapter 47 before we go into chapter 48? The last chapter of Ezekiel. So we're all fat and happy to go into 48. Well, I guess I'll go ahead and read. It's a little torturous. And I do want to get through it. I'll try to. So I'm going to read 29 verses.
You going for the whole enchilada?
No, it goes to 30-something on. Right. So I'm going to stop just short, but hopefully we'll get there. That's the idea. We've got a while still, so. To see what kind of rabbits, but to shoot the rabbits. Bam, bam. These are the names of the tribes from the northern border along the road to Heflon at the entrance of Hamath to Hazar Enon, the border of Damascus northward in the direction of Hamath. There shall be one section for Dan from its east to its west side. By the border of Dan from the east side to the west, one section for Asher. By the border of Asher from the east side to the west, one section for Naphtali. For the border of Naphtali from the east to the west, one section for Manasseh. By the border of Manasseh from the east side to the west, one section for Ephraim. By the border of Ephraim from the east side to the west side, one section for Reuben. By the border of Reuben from the east side to the west side, one section for Judah. By the border of Judah from the east side to the west shall be the district which you shall set apart, 25,000 cubits in width and in length, the same as one of the other portions, from the east side to the west, with the sanctuary in the center. So this is that part that divides the two sections where the sanctuary of the temple is. The district that you shall set apart for the Lord shall be 25,000 cubits in length and 10,000 in width. to these, to the priests, the holy district shall belong. On the north, 25,000 cubits in length, on the west, 10,000 in width, on the east, 10,000 in width, and on the south, 25,000 in length. The sanctuary of the Lord shall be in the center. It shall be for the priests of the sons of Zadok who are sanctified, who have kept my charge, who did not go astray when the children of Israel went astray as the Levites went astray. And this district of land that is set apart shall be to them a thing most holy by the border of the Levites. Opposite the border of the priests, the Levites shall have an area, 25,000 cubits in length and 10,000 in width. Its entire length shall be 25,000 and its width 10,000. And they shall not sell or exchange any of it. They shall not alienate this best part of the land, for it is holy to the Lord. The 5,000 cubits in width that remain along the edge of the 25,000 shall be for general use by the city, for dwellings in common land, and the city shall be in the center. Verse 16. These shall be its measurements: the north side 4,500 cubits, the south side 4,500, the east side 4,500, and the west side 4,500. The common land of the city shall be to the north 250 cubits, to the south 250, to the east 250, and to the west 250. The rest of the length alongside the district of the holy section shall be 10,000 cubits to the east and 10,000 to the west. A picture is worth 1,000 words. So I'm working on 1,000 words. It shall be adjacent to the district of the holy section, and its produce shall be food for the workers of the city. Produce. The workers of the city from all the tribes of Israel shall cultivate it. The entire district shall be 25,000 cubits by 25,000 cubits four square. You shall set apart the holy district for the property of the city. The rest shall belong to the prince on one side, and on the other of the holy district and of the city's property next to the 25,000 cubits of the holy district as far as the eastern border, and westward next to the 25,000 as far as the western border adjacent to the tribal portions, it shall belong to the prince. It shall be the holy district, and the sanctuary of the temple shall be in the center. That must be the longest sentence in the Bible, longest verse in the Bible. Actually, I don't think it is, but it's up there close.
Yeah.
Verse 22. Moreover, apart from the possession of the Levites and the possession of the city, which are in the midst of what belongs to the prince, the area between the border of Judah and the border of Benjamin shall belong to the prince. As for the rest of the tribes, from the east to the west, now we're going to go down the southern section. Benjamin shall have one section by the border of Benjamin from the east to the west. Simeon shall have one section by the border of Simeon from the east to the west. Issachar shall have one section by the border of Issachar from the east side to the west. Zebulun shall have one section by the border of Zebulun from the east to the west. Gad shall have one section by the border of Gad on the south side toward the south. The border shall be from Tamar to the waters of Meribah by Kadesh along the brook to the great sea. This is the land which you shall divide by lot as an inheritance among the tribes of Israel. These are their portions, says the Lord God.
Well done.
So that was all about these stripes of land again, right? So we read from Dan down to Judah, and then it talked about a lot of details in this portion here. Whoop. Which one am I at?
Yeah, just push harder.
That one there. So this here.
Yeah.
Is the.
My map doesn't really highlight that center portion.
That's because you're reading.
It's different maps, yeah.
Yeah, that's not the millennial period.
Well, it might be if it's right here in Ezekiel.
Yeah, it's just right there.
It's got some, like she says, there's, you've got.
This is back when
restoration of land.
Yeah, no, I guess it does look like it's probably the same, because it has Judah here, Jerusalem, yeah. And Benjamin, Simeon, Issachar. Yeah,
it's still the same.
I guess it just still names these.
Yeah, it just names her, they're not tribes. Anyway, you can see here there's Levites, and then the priests are the Zadok guys, who are a subset of the Levites. And then there's this business where there's land for the city itself. And then off to the sides of this Oh. Ah! It's even bigger.
All right. I'll try and do it upside down.
There's the prince.
Okay, so then there's the prince's portion on the sides. Kind of. Anyway. How did it get so big? And why don't, there we go. There we go.
I don't really want to make a rabbit, but I'm just having like a sort of.
Oh, Mary.
Go ahead.
Well, the thing about Dan, because he's listed here, but he's not listed in that Revelation part.
Right.
But is not the same timing?
No, not necessarily. So, okay, so first off, the first thing I think to think about is that God is going to preserve all 12 tribes. Right? And so, because there's a portion where when the disciples, apostles, come up to Jesus and say, you know, we've left everything to follow you, what are we going to have? And he says, each of you will sit on a tribe, or on a throne, judging the tribes of Israel. Okay, and so there's implication there, as well as what, if we look for tribal names in the New Testament, we find that the tribes are still around. So when you get to the book of Revelation, it mentions who's protected during, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's, you know, they've got with these them. 12 groups of 12,000 that God puts a mark on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then it essentially says all these plagues that come after this don't harm these particular individuals. And we have to infer why that is and what they're doing. But Dan is not listed there. And so the implication is that there are not 12,000 from the tribe of Dan that are specially marked during that time and protected. And the mark implies protection. And so there's an inference, at least there, that that's a judicial ruling by God that Dan has done something in the past that's mm-hmm. not so great. And so, and that would be similar to, in this takes place after the tribulation.
Mm-hmm.
And in here we see that a subset of the Levites have preference over the Levites, and the Levites, God keeps reminding the Levites that, you know, you went south. You went AWOL when the Zadok guys didn't. So in the millennium, here's part of one tribe, the Levites. The Zadok guys have favor, but the rest of the Levites, they're pushed away one stage from where the favor they had. And the reason that happened is because of sin in the past. And so we apply that to the Revelation setting too, then there's people who believe that Dan is essentially not protected during that period of time because of the same reason that Dan was active in the introduction of idolatry into Israel, essentially. I think the guy who's the first one to blaspheme God and be stoned for it, and thinking he's a Danite, or went on the Sabbath. I can't remember what the situation is, but that in itself isn't so big. But there's a period in time where the tribe of Dan is active in introducing idolatry into Israel. And so that's what many people think is the reason Dan isn't listed there. But it doesn't mean that every member from the tribe of Dan is going to be wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just saying that there's special protection over, and even what it's saying there, it's like when it says 12,000 from this tribe, 12,000 from that tribe, well, there may be more than 12,000 alive from each tribe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just not among this group that gets the special mm-hmm. mark. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to die, but they don't have this protection. So I don't know
what
you can make of it. But when we get to this millennial setting, the tribes are all in existence again.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we looked at a couple things here earlier, and I'll go over them again briefly, just because they're one is that even though God is pronouncing a time of blessing and favor, we've already seen he's given the Levites a little bit of a negative in this, right? He's called out the fact that they're not going to be closest to him. They're not going to be priests. They're going to be serving in the temple, but the priests are going to be from Zadok. It's a subset. So in the midst of this, he still kept the Levites in the second location closest to him. So it's important to think about the fact that even though he's pointing out their apostasy in the past, they're still given a better position than, you know, Judah or Benjamin, right? And so it's like nothing to snuff at, right? So, you know, sometimes we can, you know, look at the glass and it's an eighth empty and forget that it's seven-eighths full.
Yeah.
When it comes to Levites, it's an eighth empty, but it's, or, you know, a twelfth empty or whatever it is, and it's 11-12 full still. They're, you know, they're, and even then, the Zadokites that get the closest, they are Levites. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a part of Levi still gets the closest position. So even though they're you know, it's a negative, it's not a huge negative. But still God does, he's still pointing out in this position that they're going to have a situation that reflects their sin in the past. So even though the sin is no more, there's a ramification from it and still a memory of it. And you have to pretty much say the same thing about Dan. I mean, if you think being closest to the temple is the best,
yeah,
and he talks about this being the favored land,
mm-hmm,
Dan's way up here in the far north Netherland, right? And then as you get down close here, he's actually taken, so this is a little bit weird because in the way the northern and southern kingdoms split up, you actually, when they first split off, you had the 10 tribes to the north, and then the two tribes that remained in the south were Judah and Benjamin. And so Judah and Benjamin had the throne of David, and the 10 tribes didn't. And they had the golden calf, right? So there was idolatry there. But the fact is that the 10 tribes, so there's all these different things that weave into this, but the main point I'm trying to make is that the 10 tribes were taken out in 722 when the northern kingdom was judged for its apostasy. Now, a lot of people from the 10 tribes had already come down to the southern kingdom before that. And that's one of the reasons that all the tribes weren't lost. But overall, the northern kingdom went faster, further into apostasy, did not have the guarantees of the promise to the throne of David. The throne of David was in the southern kingdom. So the northern kingdom, by their behavior and by the fact that they didn't have the Jerusalem and the throne of David, they ended up getting judged and essentially dispersed first. And then it was only, you know, from 722 to about 586 or so before the southern kingdom was destroyed. Well, the southern kingdom was largely made up of Benjamin and Judah and then some stragglers from the other 10 kingdoms. Well, so Benjamin and Judah here, you would expect, you know, you expect to maybe see 10 up north and 2 down south, but you don't. You see it split differently. And one of the things that you see, which is surprising somewhat, is Judah and Benjamin are split. One's to the north and one's to the south. But when you think about it more from a point of view of favor, they're both closest to the temple,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So even though Benjamin, you know, and Judah would normally be considered part of the southern, this isn't the same as the southern and northern,
yeah,
kingdom, obviously, but what I'm trying to say is that Judah and Benjamin are on opposite sides of the temple, which is a little surprising because they've been so close together in their land allotments and in their unity throughout the history of Israel, and now they're split across each side of the temple. But really, what's being shown there is they're both getting a lot of favor.
Because they're both next to it.
They're
if they were together, one of them's going to be farther away.
Exactly. And so, really, you've got the Zadokites now, the second, if you look at it as a bullseye, you've got God in the center, then you've got the Zadokites, then you've got the Levites, then you have the prince, his portions and stuff. Then you have Judah and Benjamin, both closer than any of the other tribes. So again, you see, you know, several things here. One being that the southern kingdom did stay closer to God for longer than the north kingdom, and that was Judah and Benjamin. And of course, the other thing you see here is that Judah, of course, is the tribe from which Jesus came from. Mary's tribe, it's David's tribe, it's Joseph's tribe. You know, it's the tribe that God worked through primarily to bring, well, not primarily, but he worked through to bring the Messiah. So then people look at the other tribes and try to determine what are the other aspects to determine how they're laid out, and it gets, you know, increasingly more difficult to kind of figure out why he laid it out exactly the way he did. Because, you know, there's certain things when you look at, you can look at, like in these 12 tribes, you've got four different women, right? There's the two main wives of Abraham, and then you've got the, you know, Leah and Rachel, and then you've got their maids that were involved, right?
Right.
And so when you look at the chart of which, the order of the sons and which woman they came from or which handmaid they came from, you can start to see some potential associations that may explain some of it. So I don't know, it's complicated. Mm-hmm. And it, like one commentator observed that if you look at how the tribes are laid out there, the sons of Leah and Rachel are closer to the temple, and the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah are further from the temple.
Except Joseph.
I don't have the chart with me right now. I wish I had brought it with me. I have a chart on who came from what and the order and everything.
Well, Joseph and Benjamin came from Rebecca.
Yeah.
Rachel. Sorry.
Benjamin. Joseph and Benjamin. Right.
And those were the ones. That was the one that was his favorite. And I'm always wondered why God does that, because that one was weird.
Yeah, but even then, if you look at
that, Leah gets the favor and Judah and all, you know.
Right.
Well,
but
the
I guess
whole thing was a big old trick. You know.
Yeah. Well, okay. So yeah. So there's that whole issue. Like I was trying to describe to a Muslim guy who was close to coming to faith in Christ, and I'm not really sure if he did or not. But I interacted with him with email for quite a while. And he was asking me questions like, you know, what's this rascal doing this and that in the Old Testament? And I kept trying to tell him, well, that rascal's just like you. You're a rascal. And it's not about whether somebody is a rascal or an angel in that setting. It's about the promises of God.
Yeah.
Because we're all rascals to different degrees, mm-hmm. right? Just like the thieves on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all rascals to some degree, and parts of the Old Testament are offensive because the rascal gets away with his rascally lie and even benefits from it.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to come to understand is God is not endorsing the rascal behavior or the lie. He's saying, I've made a promise and I'm doing something through this line. Like when he says, I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And then, you know, Abraham and Isaac, both in different settings, lie about their wives and get these Gentiles in near dangerous positions, and God has to intervene in a dream or whatever. And God says things like, well, unless you restore this man's wife, you will die.
Mm-hmm.
So he lies to you, and then God comes in and gives you that. Well, how does that work? Well,
yeah.
The way it works is this guy has a very special role in the economy of God, and his sin is not going to change that role.
Mm-hmm.
God is not happy with what took place, but he's recording the bare fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, comes into this business with Rachel and Leah, too. But I think what that guy was saying is that if you look at all these names, and I haven't verified this because I don't have the chart with me, but, you know, Judah and Reuben and Benjamin and Simeon, these ones are ones that are from Rachel and Leah, and the ones that are further out are not. That's, you know, so people try to see patterns in it. And I don't know, you know, sometimes when you see a pattern, it isn't an intentional pattern, it's just something you notice that's
closer. But Ephraim and Manasseh are from Rachel.
But still, as long as everybody in this group is from either Leah or Rachel, it's still what he says holds.
Right.
It's not until you get past that where you get to Naphtali, Asher, and Dan that you start to see the secondary handmaids, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, but again, I haven't, this is just from a commentary that is generally trustworthy, but I haven't actually verified it. So. So anyway, that's the land division, and so again, you have this issue. If you're not understanding this to be about land divisions in some geopolitical area, what does it mean?
Yeah.
Right? Because we just read through, it's kind of excruciating, right? And the half of 47 and virtually all of 48 is talking about borders and tribes and boundaries. And so, you know, I would challenge anyone to turn that into a consistent spiritual lesson. If I get to take 10 guys who want to do it that way, and I get to separate them into 10 different rooms where they can't communicate with one another, okay, tell me, what does this passage mean? And then they all come and present it. They're not going to agree on what it means. Because you have to be pretty creative.
Yeah.
I mean, there's spiritual lessons. I'm not saying you can't get spiritual, come up with some spiritual lessons from it. You know, like some of the things we're talking about, that, well, Judah and Benjamin, look, they're close to the temple. So people who are closer to God will be blessed. You know, those are general principles that are in there too. But when you get down to the details of, you know, the strips of land and who, the exact order and everything else, it's like, you know, how do you relate that to being a Christian today? So there's always, you know, when people talk about how to study the Bible, there's this observation, interpretation, application. Well, there's always application. If there's not application, we're not doing things right. We should be able to jump into any part of the Bible, read it, observe it in context, interpret it in its historical context correctly, and then draw application from it, you know. And here, there's all, you know, we've already seen some of the application you can draw. Look what he's saying about the Zadok guys.
Mm-hmm.
And like we pointed out at the time when we first introduced that whole concept, these Levites that are getting second position behind the ones that are Zadok, they're the great 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 grandson of the guy who was apostate, right? From that, you can understand that we have this aspect where we individually respond to God, either righteously or not. But we're still affected by choices made. And if you want to complain about it, then go get a hold of the neck of Adam. Right? Because ultimately, why do you need to be saved? Why should you have to be born again? Why should you have to do what God wants in order to be saved? Why can't you just be righteous before God? Why is it that you've got this sin problem? Was it your fault? Did you do it? Well, right? So then there's this whole business of, well, when Adam, it says that when Adam fell, all fell in Adam, well, what does that really mean? And there's all this theology about, well, he's the federal representative, he's the seminal representative, your seed is in Adam,
yeah.
Your DNA was in Adam, you participated in Adam's fall biologically in some minute, strange way. But it's pretty hard to make a case that you consciously contributed to his rebellion.
Right.
Right? I mean, mm-hmm. pretty hard to make that case. But the Bible says that you're in the effects of Adam. And so it's much like the cocaine baby, right? Enters the world, what does the little baby do?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing. But it's affected by what the mother did.
But it's pretty clear, too, that put someone else in Adam's place, they would have fallen. That's just the nature of you or I.
Right.
We were there.
Right.
We were. I mean, it doesn't get more than you're born basically perfect. You know, they had everything, and then
right.
they still chose that.
Right.
So.
And I think, you know, the fact that his name essentially means man.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't really matter which man.
Mm-hmm.
Or woman.
Yeah, he gets the bad rap and should, but.
Right.
It doesn't matter which man, because
right.
it would have been any man. Seems to be.
Yeah, seems to be.
Yeah. Seems
right.
to be.
Yeah.
And on the flip side of it, too, I'm always thinking, I know that I have ancestors that prayed.
Exactly.
And.
Like my grandma was a
believer. In spite of myself, I got saved because
yeah.
of it. You
yeah.
know, because God answered their prayer. I believe that.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. You know, so so it's one of those things that you know, especially in our culture, it's kind of a difficult thing for people to swallow, this idea of dependence, that you are not the independent, totally disconnected from everything else person that you think you might want to be, right? Because there's a real big emphasis on, you know, people determining their own destiny, being free from other people, just doing your own thing and everything. And partly what the Bible is trying to say is that sin has an ongoing effect. And so everybody is born in need of salvation. Well, why are you born in need of salvation? What did you do wrong, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, even it was not that many weeks ago we were here when Doug was here. And I brought up this issue of original sin, and he was asking me about that. Well, you know, how biblical is that? The idea of original
sin. How biblical
sin.
Is that?
Yeah. And
I must have been here.
So I was a little taken back by that, because I'm like, wow, you know. I have never had that question before, but it's the reason I'm bringing it up isn't to criticize his understanding or anything. I'm just mentioning that to a lot of people it's a strange concept, the idea that you needed redemption before you sinned.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's hard to be in this culture and think anything other than that, because we're now, you know. Because of things that happen to you is what makes you do things.
Right.
You know, you.
But even then, the question in the discussion was, well, you know, when a baby is born,
yeah.
You know, they're innocent.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, but watch their reaction to not getting what they want.
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, you know, anyone who's really watched kids knows how early you can see sin. It's
okay.
Very early. It's like
very.
Right away. They're selfish little monsters right from the get-go.
But then there's the, when you get into that, then there's the twist that they're innocent until they're you know, age of accountability. And where that's at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
I have different ideas about that, too, right?
Oh, I understand. But I'm saying is it gets more complicated.
Right.
Because
yeah,
that means there cannot be sin in the womb.
But see, that's
yeah, so
that's the thing. You know, not the, I've never when they tell it that they get some, you know, they pick usually King David and what he says,
right?
And I'm still going, that's a little big.
Right. So the passages they would use on that is the parts where it talks about ones that don't know how to choose the right from the wrong, like mm-hmm. in Isaiah 7, before the child knows to choose the right mm-hmm. from the wrong, or there's so many thousand in Nineveh that can't decide between the right and the left, you know. But, you know, so like when you watch Left Behind, the mm-hmm. movie, right?
Usually the
all the kids are gone.
Yeah.
So if you believe Left Behind, which I don't, I believe a lot of Left Behind, but I don't believe that part of it. You really want to be born like less than 8 years before the rapture. Because if you're still around just before the rapture and you're sucking your thumb, it really doesn't matter what you did, you're going to be saved. Wow, what a special group of people. But the problem is that like completely bypasses election.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The Bible mm-hmm. teaches election. Where did election go?
Because I came up because somebody told that to me. I said, then it'd be better if I was stillborn. Because you're dead. If you could go
soon,
you right. want to be
want to go soon.
Right, right. now. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And abortion would be merciful.
Yeah, abortion would be merciful. And you know, if you have young kids, you better. You know, this just gets really. I don't like to say it. It gets kind of crazy.
Yeah,
and I think those are little indicators.
I didn't
indicators.
Do this rabbit.
I think those are little indicators that there's maybe some problems with that assumption.
I'm innocent.
So the Bible definitely does talk about young people being in a morally different category as far as understanding right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's real clear. Whether the statements taken in concert can teach the idea that everyone who's killed as a baby is going to be in heaven, I think that's problematic because it's essentially saying God calls and elects except
mm-hmm.
for kids that die when they're young, or right. they're always among the elect.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who dies young is by definition among the elect, right? They're going
to
be in heaven.
I went to
so it opens up all these weird questions.
I went to a kid's funeral. A kid died really early, a couple of weeks, and I went to the funeral and I was sitting there and I went, I elbowed Kathy and said, you know, the way they're talking, that kid just bypassed the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm mm-hmm. going, is it, you know, and then that's when I start questioning it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
right.
Because original sin is still original sin. I don't care. It sounds cruel,
mm-hmm.
but there's a reason why he killed everything from little kids to everybody. They killed everything.
And yeah, in those towns.
Yeah, example, right. And I'm going, there's a reason why.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right.
Yeah, but then, you know, it also shows that it's not the little magic prayer that we keep convincing everybody to say to get saved, because mm-hmm. sometimes God chooses them in the womb. Like, which one am I thinking? Is it Samuel?
Yeah, there's a bunch of
them. Oh, yeah.
John the Baptist.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
Jeremiah.
Right. It's in Samuel.
Yeah. So it's a big. This is a fat, difficult
yeah, sure.
rabbit.
Yeah.
And it's also. I mean, everyone here I know pretty well, so it's not. But I would hesitate to talk about it a lot in larger Christian groups because some people are extremely sensitive on this issue, and you can see why they might be, especially people who are really. Gifted in evangelism.
Yeah.
This is a real. I mean, this is one of the topics that came up with Jack, where things got a little bit hot.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's also the issue that what if you've lost the young one?
That's a tough one.
Right.
People put a lot of hope in that.
Right. So, anyway.
Well, if you believe in his justice,
right,
you don't have to define that. To the nth degree, you just
you
have
can.
To trust it.
Right,
mm-hmm.
God is good and he does what's right.
He's mm-hmm. just. And if that, not saying you can interpret that any way you want, but there's, it doesn't say, so.
You can't be dogmatic.
No, you yeah. can't either way. And so you know he's just and right.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
My own comfort about it is that even if I don't understand it, I know that when I am with him, I will be in agreement with him. Because, like, right now, I might not get why it's that way or this way. and it can be really troubling. Like,
right.
You know, having to explain to somebody that, you know, that you're trying to tell them about Jesus, and then they're saying, well, then that means my husband who died last year isn't saved, and that
mm-hmm.
makes it really hard. But
if you were a Catholic, of course, it would be baptism. But a child that isn't baptized goes into limbo, you know. And in one aspect, they're closer than some other things, but they're really whacked out. I'm not sure. But they do believe that a child must be baptized. So they are recognizing original sin. That's all I'm saying.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you put that on your clothes, it's going to be weird.
Yeah. Well,
but, you know, if you're talking to someone in that situation, let's say someone did lose a young child,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't necessarily have to have the answer.
Mm-mm.
You can just, God is he's fair, and his way is the best way.
Sometimes it's
you
best.
Know?
Just
I can't give you that answer, but you
right.
can trust that he is
mm-hmm.
just and right.
Mm-hmm.
But
you
some
know?
People...
That's not going to appease everybody.
No,
right.
Some people need that reassurance for whatever reason.
Want it. Yeah.
Well,
and
yeah.
so,
yeah.
And they're going to pressure till they get it. Because
right.
they're looking for something.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're have to do it.
Right. Right. So, that's a tricky
yeah.
issue for sure. But you know, we talk about things like, well, the Trinity is worth a lifetime of study. You know, well, you know, really, every time you turn around, there's aspects of the Bible that go deeper than you think. And this issue, for example, of here. You know, like we talked about earlier, that this promise, we go back to Jeremiah and see this promise made to the Levitical priests and also the line of David. And then we looked at reasons why the prince doesn't look like he's Jesus, and he doesn't look like he's a resurrected David. And so then you end up with, well, gee, there's somebody alive today in the line of David who's leading to this prince
yeah.
line. That's a weird deal, right? And so... this issue of the continuity of which God works through different lines, or the effects of sin down through time. You know, even, you know, like I said, well, here's these Zadok guys way, way, way away from their grandfather, and look at they're having this negative effect, right? They're not going to be allowed to be, the ones that aren't Zadok aren't allowed to be close to Levites. Well, turn it around the other way, you know, up until Jesus' time, where you've got Herod's temple, who is the favored people? Levites. Well, those guys at the time of Jesus, you know, some of them were not very godly among the Levites, but they're benefiting from what happened at the golden calf, essentially. The way the Levites became the Levites was that whole
yeah.
incident at the golden calf. So the guy who is the Levite at the time of Jesus and is in the temple and has all this blessing and position, he didn't earn that.
Yeah.
His great, 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 maybe not as many greats, but his grandfather or grandmother, whatever, whoever, his grandfather, essentially, at some point, showed the zeal for God, and just like the Phineas deal, there's this blessing that came from it. And so, it works both ways. Like us, okay, we're born in America or born in England or whatever, and we're born into a culture and a time period where God is very widely known. And the Bible, I mean, the Christian God is very well, you know, the true God is known and being disseminated, preached, and the Bible's accessible. And we're not born into a lost tribe somewhere in the jungles of Malaysia or whatever,
yeah.
right? And so this is that whole thing people always will trot out. What about the lost tribes? And the biblical answer is, their forefathers put them in darkness. Well, that's not
yeah.
their fault. That's right. And it's not your blessing that you get the Bible right now, but you do,
yeah.
don't you? Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult. It's not. I'm not trying to make it trivial. I'm just saying that they're difficult subjects, but they're very real. Right? Like a cocaine baby, you know.
Yeah.
How do you refute that? You know, or a baby that's born with defects from alcoholism. right?
Yeah.
How do you refute that reality? I mean, it's a reality.
Yeah.
Is that baby responsible for that? Is that the baby's fault? I hope not. If, right? So those are real things that are really mm-hmm. there. And so the beauty of biblical truth is it lines up with experiential truth.
Yeah.
You know? And so I like to say when it comes to the lost tribes, well, they weren't always lost. You know, twice in history, everybody alive personally had a relationship with God. What happened? Right? And their version of history about these lost tribes is different than the biblical version. The biblical version of history says everybody knew and a bunch of people walked away, just like this culture is trying to get rid of God every way they can. You know, and if the Lord tarries several generations after us, what's the landscape in the United States going to look like? I mean, I've already heard people say there are people in the cities that don't know, they've never heard of Jesus in the United States. You're like, are you kidding me? Right? So.
Well, you sure use his name when you swear. Chances are.
So when you get, you know, when you get two or three generations in a culture that is rejecting Christ at every turn, you end up with a lost tribe. And then you're going to blame Christianity and the evangelists for that. Like, no.
But what we actually are, if you boil it right down to the seriousness of the sin of Adam that's passed, how serious it is, how it affects everybody, and to what degree, it's just because that's what sin is. That's why he said not to do it. So it comes up there, we're trying, as humans, trying to smooth over places that we don't want to see, but here again, it's just the ramifications of sin, and it's just going to be messy.
And there's a curse. You know, we have death, we have entropy, it's all part of this original sin.
Mm-hmm. But that's what I mean. But as humans, we try to smooth it over and find everything we can to give ourselves hope for kids or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's why the culture overall says that people are basically good.
Mm-hmm.
The environment that causes it.
Right. Yeah.
We got 5 verses to go. Do you think we can make it?
I'll do it.
30 through 35. Who's gonna?
I'll do it.
Oh yeah, look
I'll
at
bring him. Her home.
Look at that.
He's volunteered to go back.
And then the credit for 48 chapters.
Cut all the hard words. I can just wrap up.
I don't know. There's quite a few tricky words.
Where am I at? Where am
30, verse 30.
30. Okay. Oh, I can.
Chapter 48.
Yeah. These are the exits of the city. On the north side, measuring 4,500 cubits, the gates of the city shall be named after the tribes of Israel. The 3 gates northward, 1 gate for Reuben, 1 gate for Judah, 1 gate for Levi. On the east side, 4,500 cubits, 3 gates, 1 gate for Joseph, 1 gate for Benjamin, 1 gate for Dan. On the south side, measuring 4,500 cubits, 3 gates, 1 gate for Simeon, 1 gate for Issachar, 1 gate for Zebulun. On the west side, 4,500 cubits, with their 3 gates, 1 gate for Gad, 1 gate for Asher, and 1 gate for Naphtali. All the way around shall be 18,000 cubits, and the name of the city from that day shall be, the Lord is there.
Hooray! The last verse of Ezekiel! I could have brought my shofar.
Yeah.
Amazing. High five, man!
Absolutely.
All right. So.
Wow.
So this is real similar. What's a little different here is, of course, in the tribe of Israel, there were always the 12 tribes camped around in groups of 3, 4 groups of 3. And so the idea of the 4 groups of 3 around the temple goes clear back to the tabernacle in the wilderness. So like when Balaam's up on the mountain, he's supposedly going to curse Israel. He doesn't, but when he looks down on Israel, camped in the plains, he sees them camped in groups of three, four groups of three on various sides of the temple or tabernacle. And so this whole idea of, you know, four sides with three on each of the sizes goes way back to that, and it's continued on in the eternal state too, right? In Revelation 21, when it talks about the gates of the New Jerusalem, Revelation 21:12, it talks about 12 gates and 12 angels at the gates, and it says that names are written on the gates, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. So there's another reason why the 10 tribes aren't lost. But so it says three gates on the east, three gates on the north, three on the south, three on the west. It doesn't tell us which one, which name.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same idea that there's these three gates on each of the four sides, and it's they're associated with the tribes. And it goes on to say that there are these 12 foundations, and that has the names of the apostles of the Lamb. Notice it's distinguishing here between Israel and the church, but that's a whole other issue. So when you look at how these tribes used to were originally camped out, in each of the group of three tribes, one tribe was the lead tribe, if you were, well, so, and it had a standard, a flag, with presumably symbols on it, and and so there was, like, on the east in the tabernacle in the wilderness, you had Judah with Issachar and Zebulun, and but it was the camp of Judah, it was called. And so even when they marched and they broke camp and marched and stuff, there was an order they marched in. Judah would be the very first to go, and so Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun would be the three tribes launching, you know, going out first, essentially. And then the last group, of course, Dan, was the last group was associated with Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. But so you had Judah first and Dan last. And then when you look at how this is lined up now, it gets I think it's harder to figure out, you know, what the positions are. When you look at like one of the things that happens on this whole thing is the position of favor, if you can say they're one, it gets rotated, because remember the east gate gets sealed off. Right. So whereas before the position of favor was Judah on the east side, which was the entrance, now you have the north side, I'm guessing, is a position of favor, because it rotates. It's hard to say for sure, but that's the first one that's mentioned, is the north side, whereas before the first side that was mentioned was the east. But anyway, it's hard to, you know, it's all tentative for me to try and make sense of it, but it is interesting that the first group here in Ezekiel 48, Reuben, Judah, and Levi, they're all sons of the unlost wife, Leah. Which is kind of neat when you think about it. Because when you read that whole little section there where with Leah and Rachel, you know, God definitely, through the writing there, definitely points out this business. You can sense when you read through it that God is not happy with the fact that Leah is unloved.
Mm-hmm.
So there again, you've got Jacob the scoundrel, you know, behaving certain ways that are recorded. But if you read carefully, you can see that God's not real pleased with it, and so, you know, he gets duped by Laban, you know, and gets Leah before Rachel, but then he just duped his dad.
Yeah.
Right. So there's this whole business of sowing and reaping, and
I know.
And his dad was involved in some duping stuff too. So it's just the whole thing just gets messy. But I think it's neat here anyway that the first group that are mentioned in the millennium are these three. But I don't know how much to make of that, you know.
Well, and Leah is the first wife, and there shouldn't have been another wife after that.
Well, yeah, so there's all different ways you there's all different ways you could look at it, but yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Even though I felt, yeah.
See, that's another good example where people will point to biblical precedent as denoting that it's God's will when it's not, right?
Yeah.
Polygamy,
yeah,
is not, you know, when you go back to Genesis 3 and 2, you
no.
don't see polygamy, you see monogamy. And so polygamy occurs just like divorce occurs, and then what did Jesus tell us about divorce?
Yeah.
It was not from the beginning, it was not so, it's not God's idea. Anyway, I don't have a lot intelligent to say about
well, and just kind of to emphasize your point, any, you know, I've heard some try and make a case, well, because there were these people have multiple wives and look all this that came from it, and that God doesn't seem to be just hammering on it in the text necessarily, not blatantly so, but look at the fallout. If you really just read what happens to these families, that shows you the fallout.
Right.
God doesn't have to bam a sign. He just look at all the turmoil and chaos and dysfunction every time there's multiple wives.
Yeah.
From David to son, you know, and all these, yeah.
Yeah.
Just,
and there,
that tells you it's not God's original plan, even though he worked amazing things through it. You know?
Right. So that's one of the frustrations that you frequently encounter when you're talking with people about the Bible, is that the majority of people who have these views or complain about the Bible aspects of it or try to use the Bible for their benefit in a way that isn't really biblical, they're not believers and they haven't necessarily spent that much time in the Bible, so they haven't gotten past the surface to
yeah.
see the undercurrents that are very clear
yeah.
there, where God, you know, that the Bible says God records this is what the person said, just like Job, you know. You have to be careful when you read Job. If you go fishing in Job to make doctrinal assertions, you can be citing the guys who are in error.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, God says these guys, they give these long, and there's a lot of wisdom in what they say, but God in the end says, well, your friends are all wrong. It's like, okay, well, which of those did I draw on to make my point this
yeah.
last Sunday school,
yeah.
right? And did I use it the right way? And so it gets back to this business of, it's, you know, it's like when people say, well, Jesus never said anything negative about homosexuality, for example, which is a little bit different, but anyone who's really read the Bible is just like so exasperated
yeah.
by a statement
yeah.
like that. It's like, yeah, so?
Right.
Right? What's that mean? Doesn't mean anything. Right? Doesn't mean anything.
Every jot and tittle.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. You know, it's like Mary said, he did.
Yeah,
he
yeah.
did say a lot about it when he said, not one jot or tittle
yeah.
will pass from the law, you know. And he says it's better for, you know, anyone who misleads one of these little ones, it's better for a millstone to be thrown around your neck or whatever and thrown into the sea. I mean, there's a bunch of things he says where he endorses the teachings of the Old Testament. Of course he has to. If he doesn't, we don't even have Christianity.
Yeah.
Well, he's the Word.
Yeah.
That's all of it.
Yeah. But again, it's this business where it gets back to those that will see and have eyes to see will push through those things and see those things, and those that don't, it's just exasperating because it's like, what do you get, you know? But the key thing of along with the fact that this, you know, they got these 12 groups, 12 tribes around, and the that there's going to be gates, is the last verse, of course. The Lord will be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you look at one of the big, what do you want to call it, themes of Ezekiel, if you kind of step back and there's a lot of big themes in Ezekiel, but one of the biggest themes is the departure and return of God's glory. Because the whole first part of the book is basically talking about the sin and problems in the southern kingdom, and especially the religious leaders in the temple, that make God leave, right? And so the fact that now he's saying the Lord is there is a, you know, you can connect that verse 35 there to, I keep bringing this verse up because it just comes up all the time, but the last verse of Matthew 23 where Jesus says to Jerusalem, the same city, right? Jesus says to Jerusalem, you won't see me until you say, right? What's this say here? The name of the city from that day shall be the Lord is there. Well, those two are connected, right? Because that's what Jesus is essentially saying when he's saying that at the end of Matthew 23. He's saying Ezekiel 48:35 won't happen until you say, and then I will come and the Lord is there. The Lord will be there. That's the final chicken. The final chicken. So any other questions or thoughts?
Quite a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.